Hello, welcome to the IPR podcast. I am your host, Ruoyu Li, and today we are so excited to have Christopher Pace and Marina Cantacuzino joining us. Chris is an international political theorist interested in continental political thought and democratic theory, and his work deals directly with the question of forgiveness. Marina is a journalist and the founder of the Forgiveness Project in 2004. Marina and Chris will tell us about a recent interview between them where they discussed the Forgiveness Project, an organization whose peace activism is devoted to the collection and curation of testimonies that bear witness to the transformative power of nonviolent restorative responses to conflict, crime, and injustice. The first question is for Marina. While reading the interview, I was so captured by the variety of dispositions and meanings that people have for forgiveness. It could be a powerful choice, a political gesture, an act of aggression or even insult, a restorative process, and so on. So Marina, could you share some interpretations of forgiveness that you found transformative or impressive when working on the Forgiveness Project?
Yes, thank you for asking that. You're absolutely right. I think the thing that fascinated me most about collecting stories, and my background is journalism, so I've always known the power of story. Stories stick, whereas facts fade, I always think. But in the course of many years of talking to people about what it meant to forgive, I realized it was multidimensional, multi-layered, easily misunderstood, open to interpretation, not always welcome, and actually not always appropriate or helpful. So this is what fascinated me about this subject. And it was also a word no one could agree on in terms of they defined it differently. Their motivation was always different. But the biggest common drive, if you like, is that I think pain is the great motivator to forgive. So people try other methods. They try medication, they try to retreat into silence, they try revenge, they try self-harm, and sometimes they also make a very conscious decision to forgive. So it can be as direct as that. So for instance, a woman called Fegan Murray, whose son was killed in the Manchester Arena bombings when Ariana Grande was playing, and a lot of very young people were killed, she speaks about needing to demonstrate the values that were so lacking when her child was killed. And it was a very conscious decision. And it came out of, once she decided it, that was her forward path. Everything in her life was from then on going to be about forgiveness, empathy, compassion. Equally, Kemal Pavanic, who comes from Bosnia and was in the concentration camp, eventually also sought to forgive his captors and his torturers. He said, "I didn't decide not to hate because I'm a good person. I decided not to hate because hating would have finished the job they'd started so successfully." Again, a very conscious decision to not bring more hatred into the world, because that would make them feel like they were sullied and in some way perverted, like the person who caused the damage. People also do it to feel better in themselves. It's a psychological need to feel wholesome and free.
And an example of that is someone called Stacey Bannerman,
who's an American whose husband was a vet. He'd been to Iraq. He came back very damaged and became very violent. And it wasn't so much she did forgive him because she saw that he was the reason why he had become violent. It was more the American people that she hated. She hated them with a vengeance, because they 75% had voted and wanted this war, and 99% has sacrificed nothing for it. She decided in the end that she couldn't carry on with these feelings that were poisoning her. Again, forgiveness became a lifeline, an act of survival. And she talks about, "I had to decide that being reconciled with what had happened was more important than being right about why it never should have happened." I was also fascinated by people who wouldn't use the word forgiveness, because even though they acted in a very forgiving way and people would have interpreted it as forgiveness, they didn't choose to use it. So Rami Alahan, the Israeli whose daughter was killed in a suicide bomber, said, "I don't forgive and I don't forget, but The suicide bomber was a victim, just like my daughter. He'd grown bitter through being shamed and through poverty. So that interested me as well. There were these deeply, what I would have thought were very, very forgiving people who wanted to find reconciliation and peace and talked about empathy and compassion, but absolutely wouldn't use the word. And then the last example that I'd just like to raise is self-forgiveness. I was also interested by how people thought about forgiving themselves and how some people felt they deserved it and others didn't. And actually it made very little difference to the value that they created in the world. Because, for instance, there are two violent extremists. One is a former white supremacist, and he was absolutely convinced that if he didn't forgive himself, he wouldn't be able to do the work with young people to prevent further violence in the world. He said, I'd be too busy beating myself up the whole time. Whereas former jihadist that I spoke to said, if I forgave myself and it was all washed away and cleansed, how would I carry on helping others make reparation people? Because that was the work that he did as well. They both worked to counter violent extremism, but both saw self-forgiveness in a very different way. One as deeply helpful and important, the other as not deserved and as actually quite damaging. So these were just a sprinkling of examples of the multitude of stories that I came across.
Thank you, Marina, for sharing. So for Chris, I love how you curated the questions and your concluding remarks in the interview. Could you share with our audience what you learned from your interview with Marina and from the Forgiveness Project?
Absolutely. So thank you first for your kind words about my contributions to the piece and for your terrific question. I would say at least three things come to mind. And each of these three things pertain to the ways in which Marina and her colleagues have found a meaningful way to advocate for peace and nonviolent responses to harm in terms of an idea and form of practice, the practice of forgiveness. That is, as I say in my commentary, and as Marina notes throughout various places of her broader body of written work, this incredibly divisive idea. First, I would say my work with Marina has therefore left me with a deeper understanding of the affectivity of forgiveness and how it is possible through storytelling to manage and perhaps leverage in a meaningful way what scholars of affect theorists, might describe as the intensity engendered by the morally charged, politically polarizing character of forgiveness. So this is why, you know, in my my closing remarks of our piece, I use Stephen Roach's work on affective values in order to theorize how certain values, such as forgiveness, for Roach, he talks about decency and other things, how certain values can foster feelings of intensity in such a way that in certain situations, political lines can be drawn or redrawn in terms of the emotional experience shaped by, for instance, this value's presence in the public realm, or it's putting into practice by particular persons or peoples. You know, I have in mind here, you know, the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I have in mind some of this array of interpersonal narratives that Marina dips and dives into in her work in order to highlight how storytelling, stories about forgiveness, create these so-called spaces in a very figurative and sometimes literal way to have a discussion about forgiveness itself and how we deal with trauma and how we heal and how in personally and socially. I would say my second takeaway, which is very much related to the first, is that Marina and her colleagues' use of storytelling provides a means for them as peace activists and as advocates of forgiveness to do their work in such a way that they can actively pursue their agenda, their activism, but doing so, however, in a decidedly non-evangelical and non-prescriptive manner, which I think is really important for doing doing advocacy. So, you know, when speaking with and learning from Marina, it is clear, you know, that for her, forgiveness is neither a universally valid cure-all form of action to be used as the single, you know, the path to salvation, nor is it even something to be understood and practiced in any particular singular way. So what I've learned is, or, you know, what I've thought more deeply about is the, you know, what I describe as the heterodox understanding of forgiveness that allows the Forgiveness Project to understand, or to approach forgiveness, understand it, and speak about it in a way that is opens up a conversation to be more inclusive in a very maybe even a global way. And then I would say the third thing that this project, the Marina, has helped me to find kind of a renewed sense of hope. You know, I think a feeling not so easily cultivated during, you know, this rather difficult time or period of history, that, through the caring about people's stories, listening to them and actively working to understand what they're saying, have experienced or are struggling with, that perhaps we can help mend our seemingly broken world in some small way, but maybe also in some larger ways. So for this little bit of renewed hope, I'm deeply grateful and very much hope IPR's readers will find something worthwhile, not only in this piece, but, but also maybe in the work of the Forgiveness Project.
Thank you, Chris. I'm sure our audience will love the piece. I guess for Marina, what value, if any, do you see in the work that Chris has done in making your project eligible to the academic study of international relations and global politics?
It's always very exciting for someone like me to have an academic pore over your work and come to it from a very different angle with new framing, new lens, new interpretation. It opens it up to a different language. I sometimes think of the academic language as a different language altogether, but I think it's essential that advocacy work like I do and my colleagues is put under that kind of microscope. And you have to be prepared for also someone to say, this just doesn't make sense, or perhaps this isn't helpful, or what's going on here. So the first thing was this emphasis on effective values, which is not something that I would have turned in that way, but was immensely helpful. And that even that forgiveness is an effective value. And I took that to mean that the word, the concept itself triggers emotional and effective states, I suppose, which feed into broader divisions and which are often divisive and dangerous, and therefore might exacerbate or reaffirm conflict. And the way you framed it in terms of opening up this almost liminal space where nuance and diversity of thought and experience can become possible. I've sort of articulated that a bit myself, but I wasn't. It's really nice to have someone say it again. And I loved it when I think you were borrowing from Hannah Arendt, Chris, and you talked about the imagination is the faculty of the mind with which we can theoretically go visiting the perspectives of other people. I found that really interesting, that sort of idea of moving in the spaces of others, which comes to the last point that really struck with me, was this whole thing around space and spatiality that goes beyond, because we have a lot of digital work, we have films, we have exhibitions, physical exhibitions. But we also, I've always talked about our events, live events that we put on. I've always talked about it in terms of public spaces made intimate. But you took it a step further, Chris, by talking about how the stories creates fields. And in those fields, people can dwell and move more freely, which automatically made me think of one of my favorite quotes by Rumi, which is, out beyond right and wrong, there is a field, I will meet you there.
I'm glad that some of the comments struck, but I'm hoping that maybe in this conversation, maybe you as a practitioner intellectual, maybe me, at least in this context, as a intellectual practitioner, have met somewhere in the middle and hopefully had a meaningful and worthwhile and useful conversation. And I'm glad that some of the things that I tried to say connected and resonated with you, Marina.
Thank you, Marina and Chris, for this wonderful conversation. And thank you for listening. Please look forward to our next episode in the IPR podcast.